Oh, yeah, yeah. We are going. Heaven knows where we are going, but we know we will. And we'll get there. Heaven knows how we will get there, but we know we will. I have always loved this hymn because it is humble but determined, confident, and clear that even our own journeys are not always under our control. The song knows that we don't know all we need to know to walk the path we set ourselves. But it also knows that we will never know all we need to know to walk the path we set ourselves. And if we waited until we knew all that we need to know, until we had foreseen and provisioned ourselves for every possible challenge and potentiality, we would never go. We would never start. So we start the best we can. And we go the best we can along the paths that we know we have to take. Paths of compassion, paths toward justice and freedom, paths that require attention and courage, paths that are tricky, hard to see, little known. Sometimes we're not just following, but forging a path through a wilderness with all the attendant hardships and dangers that any wilderness holds as we find our way through. When I graduated college, I had no idea what I should do with my life. Really, none. And it was not for lack of trying to figure it out. I just couldn't seem to think of a path that felt like the right one. So with my English and studio art double major, I went into advertising and hated it. I actually started having panic attacks on my way into work, which I thought were symptoms of a brain tumor. Because I had no idea what was going on, why I was fainting on the T on my way into work each morning. And when my doctor explained what was wrong, I couldn't believe it, and I felt embarrassed. I felt weak, and I felt stupid. Who has panic attacks just because they don't like their job? In the end, however, I stopped fighting it, and I quit my job. Now that I know ultimately I was heading to ministry, which was completely not on my radar screen at the time, it makes more sense that advertising was an untenable alternative. But at the time, I felt like a loser because I did not have the fortitude to persevere. I left the advertising job and I went to Greece where I taught English in a foreign language school for 3 years and I loved it. I loved teaching and I loved my kids and teens and I loved Greece and I learned the language and I made a life for myself and I was almost perfectly happy there. But still, I felt something was missing. Something was unfulfilled in me. And when I finally thought of ministry, it was while I was still living in Greece and had read a novel where a really good minister was one of the characters. Of course, I worried ministry wasn't really what I thought it was or that I wouldn't be good enough. I had no idea what was required or even how to begin. But I asked questions and I got answers and I threw everything I had into it. Everything. I left my beloved life in Greece and my friends and my work. And I moved here. I temped for a year to make money for my first year of divinity school. I took out massive student loans that I am still paying back. I worked every year half-time while taking a full-time course load, and I worked every summer. And I loved it. And I still didn't know if I would be a good minister, but I knew that I would be the best minister I could be. I got some comfort, therefore, when I was at a conference much later, but some years ago, for congregations and leaders who were working on growing their capacities and taking on significant challenges in the paths they were choosing as faith communities. Part of the program featured a jazz ensemble who had come up for the conference from New Orleans, which was still then in the very early days of recovery from Hurricane Katrina. These jazz musicians were extraordinary artists. Their music was dexterous and compelling and fearless. Their notes soared and dove. They played alone and together. Their melodies wove and ducked and bounced and drew you into them again and again. We heard them play, and then they talked to us about their playing. And one of the things one of them said was this: "We know what your conference is about. We know you're here to talk about forging new paths, about dealing with risk, about being faithful in ways that require courage and commitment. We know that can be intimidating, and that's why we're here. We have a lesson that we have learned after many years of devotion to our craft that we are here to share with you now. If you are not playing at the edge of your ability, you are not doing your job. If you're not playing at the edge of your ability, you are not doing your job." You musicians in the front row, are you listening? I didn't know you would be here when I was starting to write this sermon. I have been a minister now for almost 25 years, and there are still days when I worry about whether I am equal to some task or challenge, and my fallback is the same, that all I can do is be the best minister I can be. And that holds for congregations too. Part of the journey that we share has to be growing from what we already do, already are, already know, in order to respond to lives and challenges and learnings that we encounter as we go. This is why the great Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams said that one of the foundational truths of our movement is that revelation is ongoing. It's not fixed. We expect that life, as the hymn goes, life calls us on, that what we know and believe may change. It may change later today or tomorrow. Even something we were really pretty sure of may change because of an experience that we have. And so our work as Unitarian Universalists is to stay open to experience, to keep our minds and hearts open to what may come, and then check whether what we experience actually changes what we believe. And if it does, to check again about what else we need to change to do in order to make sure that the ways we are in the world are still aligned with what we now believe about the world and about life and about our own faithful living. A year and a half ago, in the week when I was meeting with you, before you called me here to be your ministry, to be your minister, many of you shared a lot of your hopes and dreams for this church, your imperatives, and your commitments. You told me you wanted to be more involved in the surrounding communities in and around Providence. You told me you wanted to be less single-handed and more collaborative. You told me you wanted to be more of a presence and more of a force, really, for goodness and for justice. You told me you wanted to grow your membership and also your own capacities within this congregation. You told me you wanted to deepen the quality of experience here. You told me you wanted to bring more newcomers into the church, more young people and families who are always the future of the church. And you told me you wanted to diversify the membership some to be less homogeneous in your makeup. Hopefully this sounds familiar because you didn't tell me these things in closed sessions. These were in meetings that I had with different groups who were different arms of this congregation. So you heard each other say these things too, a lot. Having begun down a path to build those hopes into realities at First U, it became clear to the leadership that we needed a chance for this already dynamic and strong and loving church to think not just about how it wants to be now, but who we want to be, what we hope for and need from and offer to each other. And this is why we brought Tendayaka in at the beginning of this fall, to help us discern what we're carrying and what we need from each other in this church, what we have to hold on to because it's already precious, and what we need to grow that will be essential for the nurture and future of this congregation. And what we heard from each other in the programs with her, with Tendayaka, especially in the weekend workshops that many of you attended, was a hope and a need for deeper connection here at First U. People shared that some of us feel a sense of loneliness, even sometimes having been part of this congregation for years. Sometimes it feels like there's an inner circle, and it's hard to find a way in. Sometimes it feels like there's a veil between us that keeps us from feeling as connected, as bonded, as sharing and loving as we want to be, as we have it in us to be with each other. So our time with her revealed that people want community, and this is not surprising in a congregation, but people want more community, deeper, more caring, more open, more connecting community. And that makes all the sense in the world, because these are hard times that we're living in, and it takes a lot to get through these days, and everyone feels it. Every one of us feels it. I feel it too. We dread the news, we avoid it or ration it in various and creative ways. I've had a surprising number of conversations with you in the last year about the various and creative ways people have begun to ration their news. A number of you have come to talk to me about how you're feeling, and I can say that part of what many are carrying is just exhaustion, feeling anxious and tired all the time, oppressed and sad. And just as these times are hard on individuals, they are hard, therefore, on communities made up of suffering people. And that's not just you and this congregation. I know from my colleagues that most congregations and congregants are feeling the burden and pressure of these times. So of course we need community, now more than ever, to help us hold all that we are holding. That's why we're here, for ourselves or our families to be able to share and learn and grow, even now, especially now, when it is so hard to deal. The things we want for ourselves and for this church, for our communities beyond this church, compassion, comedy, relationship, love, fulfilling and flourishing, these are all gifts of peace. Here we are in this month devoted to that eternal and elusive promise. And the thing about peace is that perhaps because it's so elusive, we speak of it as if it is a goal. And indeed, while it eludes us, it has to be our goal. But when you really think about it, peace is precious because of what it brings with it, because of what it makes possible. Peace is required for relationships to flourish, for people to be free to manifest their fullest, most creative expressions of themselves. Peace is necessary for life and for living the dreams of life and living that all people hold. That is why peace is so precious. And in this tumultuous time, this church matters even more as a place to cherish and offer each other the gifts of peace, which is really what we're doing here. To do this requires deliberation and patience and commitment. And nothing here matters more than that. This is what we need to do as a church to navigate these times and keep ourselves and each other strong and loved. And also what we need to do to meet as a community the needs and challenges of our days. So the details of this path are not always clear. And sometimes the choices we face or will face are complex. And sometimes the options are or will be daunting. And sometimes the challenges are tough. And sometimes the stakes are high. And the safety we seek to offer each other here cannot change any of that. But I do know two things. One is this. We are coming up on our 300th birthday in 2020. It's a year and a half from now. And it's not an accident that this 300-year-old church is not just still around, but thriving. This church has lived, and for the past 200 years it has lived in this stirring, built-to-last building for reasons. This congregation was founded in response to another time of challenge and difficulty, and it has stood as a bulwark and a sanctuary across centuries and lifetimes of suffering and blessing. It has not merely stood, it has held its people and welcomed more, just as now it holds us, each of us, and welcomes more. It is the nature and essence of this church that we move with our times, that we expand and stretch, that we root and deepen, because nothing left would have kept it going until now. That has always been the journey of this church, and it is still the journey of this church. So the second thing is, it's really about this way that the path forward is never wholly clear, which we've heard now from many different people this morning. We heard it from Theodore Rothke, who said, "I learn by going where I have to go." We sang that so beautifully, and we heard it from Suzanne. "Wo Ya Ya," a song from a very different culture, halfway across the planet, tells us the same wisdom. The jazz musicians from New Orleans were saying the same thing. No, the path forward is never wholly clear, but we go. We go believing that going will get us where we need to go, and understanding that we do often learn by going where we have to go. And all we can do and all we should do is to go as generously and caringly forward as we possibly can into that future. And we know at least some of the provisions that we must have with us. We know we have to have our love for each other and our commitment to each other and to the relationships that are the true structure of this congregation. And we know we have to have courage. And we know we have to have open-heartedness. We know that we have to be willing to learn, believing we do not know already everything that we need to know. And so we know that we have to be willing to grow, And we know that part of that will happen because of what we learn and gain from each other. For this journey of this church, and for all the journeys we are each on as individuals, frankly, that is all we could possibly hope for. And it is a great deal to have with us. So yeah, whoa, yeah, yeah. We are going. And the great gift we carry is each other. And we will learn by going where we have to go. Amen.